brought to you by Guatney Chevrolet at the Gregory Street exit in Jacksonville. This is Guatney Unplugged with Scott Romine.
Hey, Scott Romine here. I hope your Saturday is going fantastic. One of the most iconic voices of the 1980s, of course, is George Michael. I would put him in the league of Elvis Presley and Freddie Mercury, I would say. And we're going to talk with James Gavin. He is an author. He's written a book called George Michael, A Life. How are you, James?
I have never been better, and I'm very happy to be talking with you now at length after our short but sweet meeting at the Six Bridges Book Festival. I loved it.
That was great. And, you know, you're on YouTube, and you've got a lot of things out there. You got your own website. Where did you grow up that led to all this writing?
Well, I was born in Manhattan, as I am proud to say, but I was adopted, and so I didn't grow up in Manhattan. I grew up directly north of Manhattan in the town of Yonkers, New York, in Westchester. And at the age of 22, having spent my entire life up until that point just about dreaming of living in New York City, I graduated from college at the age of 22. I got my first shabby little $200 a month, I kid you not, share in a shared apartment on the Upper West Side of New York, where I still live. And by that time, Scott, I was 22, and in college at the age of 20, I had begun writing my first book, which was about old Manhattan nightlife and all of these wonderful little cabarets that used to be all over town that launched a lot of legendary talent. And so I moved to New York with a mission, and I was already on my path as a writer then. And that was, good heavens, that was a long time ago. That was 31 years ago that I made that big move.
You couldn't get much for $200 a month now.
For $200 a month, you couldn't get a box under an expressway. That's a whole other discussion. About what it costs to live in New York City. I have something called this ancient system called rent stabilization. I got in right under the tail end of it. And so I've lived continuously in New York for all those years. And I've been a writer as well for all those years. The George Michael book is my fifth book. That book about cabaret was my first book. And I'm also a journalist, and I've written for a lot of great places, I must say. The New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, NPR Music, Vanity Fair a couple of times. So I have lived the life of a scuffling freelance writer for all that time. But the George Michael book has, I must say, it's upped my stock a little bit. And although it's the hardest thing I've ever done, writing about this man, trying to get to the bottom of his life when I had so many layers of protection and secrecy to penetrate, to chisel away at.
Sure.
It was worth it in the end, because this book has gotten more attention than anything I've ever done, naturally, because he's a worldwide superstar, far from forgotten, although he's almost 6 years gone. And every country in the world loves George Michael. Every city in the U.S., every town, every state. George Michael left an indelible impression on people. And there are a half a dozen songs that I believe will live forever.
Oh, no question. I think your book would be a great basis for a movie. You know, people like Elvis just got a movie. Queen has a movie. George Michael needs a movie.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And I've gotten a number of requests, and one or two of them seem quite promising. But you know, Scott, it's all pie in the sky. If you ever look at Variety and Hollywood Reporter, which I occasionally do, you will see oodles of announcements of films that are supposed to go before the camera next Tuesday and then wind up never appearing. It's a total crapshoot. I'd love to see it happen. I'm not allowing myself to get my hopes up too high, because I've been down that road before, and it's foolish. I've hobnobbed with those Hollywood people a bit in my day.
Sure.
And it's very intoxicating to listen to all of that big talk and all of that talk about big money. And stars attached to your book or whatever your vehicle is. And you can easily become seduced by that kind of thing and buy into it and believe it. And most of the time you will wind up disappointed.
Sure.
So I prefer to just, I'm still working my book. It's coming out in a variety of other countries and in other languages. And astonishingly, it was published on June the 28th in the US, and then it's been released in gradually in other places. And it's still got so much life left in it. I'm still getting to happily talk with people like you who are interested in it. Some books come and go in a month. You can work on a book for 15 years and in 1 month it's gone.
Sure.
So thank you, George Michael, because I finally, as one of my friends said to me recently, you've finally written a book about somebody people care about, which is a slightly harsh. My other biographies were about Peggy Lee, Lena Horne, and Chet Baker, and a lot of people care about them. But there's a difference. They are legends, and George Michael was a superstar.
Oh, he's a big deal. But did you ever get close to meeting him? Obviously, you were a fan of his prior to selecting him. Or did you see him perform?
No, I did not. Wait a minute. I'd never met him, but I saw him when he was at Madison Square Garden with his 25 Live tour, which was a greatest hit show that toured the entire world and made an unimaginable sum of money. I saw him from afar, and I had it in the back of my head that I wanted to write about him someday because he had released an album, a heartbroken, beautiful album called Older that came out in 1996 that was about the loss of the great love of his life. And it was about all of the sadnesses that George Michael had pretty much kept under wraps until then. Mm-hmm. And that album touches me to this day through to the bottom of my heart. And so I thought maybe somehow an article, who knows, I'll get to write something about him. But it was not until literally the day he died, which was December 25th, 2016, when I heard the news, as everybody else did, on their phones amid Christmas celebrations. And within 2 hours, I texted my agent, David, and I said, everybody's going to want to write this book, but maybe I could just throw my hat in the ring, and I got to be the person to write it.
That's incredible. You write so much about music. Do you play instruments or sing yourself?
Oh, God, no. I don't. I've never studied. You wouldn't. I can carry a tune, but you wouldn't want to hear it. And I don't play an instrument. I've studied music, but not in an instrumental playing sense. Early on, I remember trying to sing along with old 78s that I'd inherited from family members by great singers like Peggy Lee and Margaret Whiting and Joe Stafford, and I knew that I couldn't do that. I didn't want to contribute more bad singing to the world. There's God knows there's enough of it already. And I was getting interested in writing and in language and storytelling because I had learned to read when I was 4 years old. So I went into kindergarten knowing how to read books. And I was utterly enchanted by the idea of books. I began surrounding myself in my bedroom in Yonkers with books and records, and they were my safe little haven. I grew up in libraries. I began going to used record stores and buying old records. And I got it in my head fairly early on that maybe I could, if not making music myself, I could tell stories about those who made music. And as it turned out, I was right. That's been my contribution to the world, to tell important stories about musicians and singers and songwriters who suffered a lot in their lives and turned it all into beautiful music that makes us feel less alone.
You know, when an audiobook comes out of something you've written, how is the person that's going to read it chosen, or do you get the opportunity to be that person?
Well, a while back, I guess in May or June or something, My editor told me, you're going to have your first audiobook. None of my other books made it to audiobook. And so one instantly assumes, if you're the author of the book, that you will be the one to read it. And I was told that I could be considered for that, but I would have to audition for my own audiobook. And I thought, well, I wrote it. Why? But then my editor went on to explain to me that it would require about 80 to 100 hours in the studio. And then I began to think, oh God, you're going to have to read your whole book again. And I thought that I'll kill myself before I get to the end of it. So cooler heads prevailed, and the company sent me little snippets, audition tapes, and so forth, of a whole bunch of professional seasoned audiobook readers, actors. And out of all of those, I chose the one that just sounded the best for the purpose. And the guy did a very nice job. And he's not a household name actor, but he put in the time and people seem to like it. And I'm so jealous of you because I love radio. I've done a lot of radio appearances in my day, but the thought of being able to talk on the radio all the time, loving radio as I do, is just so yummy to me. And
it's a lot of fun
to be able to talk. And well, you're great at it. You have a wonderful radio voice, and I can see very clearly why people want to listen to you. And that is one of my never to be realized dreams. I don't have the time to pursue it, and with guys like you around to do this, there's no need for me to do it. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing.
You've made my day. Do you like the promotion, the touring? I mean, you look at your website, jamesgavin.com. You've made a lot of appearances. You were at a book festival here in Little Rock. I guess meeting the people that are buying your book has got to be just the ultimate payoff.
It is all that and more. It's the reward for all the torture that you go through to put the damn thing together. I love meeting people. I'm grateful for every person who shakes my hand, who says something complimentary, who buys the book, who wants an inscription in it. It's people have very limited time, Scott. Everybody's got a million things to worry about, and to come out and devote the hours to meeting somebody like me or hearing me speak, that's an honor. I don't take it lightly at all. And so my experience at the Six Bridges Book Festival was sublime, and it enabled me, and this is one of the reasons why I love those travels so much, because I hadn't been to Little Rock before. I'd always wanted to go, and now I had a very good reason to do it. So I spent, in addition to the day I was only obliged to be around for the festival for one day, but I spent 5 extra days there, and I was shown the town, and I talked to so many people, and I planted my feet on that ground, and I walked everywhere through all kinds of neighborhoods. And now I feel very close to Little Rock as a result. And I could tell you a thousand stories like that. I love traveling the world, and my books they've taken me far and wide. And I would never have met you, for instance.
That's true. Yeah,
if it were not for my having been invited to that festival and just been there. So wonderful. Every one of these books, and even every article I write, it opens up whole new worlds to me. And that is the most glorious thing about what I do.
I would think that when you start researching a book like George Michael or any of these other books you've worked on, that it probably ends up going a different way than you envisioned. I would think that the research starts dictating or drawing you in a direction you didn't think about initially.
Oh, God, yes, absolutely. It always seems a little easier at the beginning than it turns out to be. And then you realize that you're in deep, murky waters. In the case of the George Michael book, I was drawn to his story because I knew that it was very dramatic and that it was a great detective story, and it was full of mystery and full of pain and full of triumph and tragedy and all those things that you want in a biography. But then the first year of writing this book, I knew this one was going to be challenging because I knew that George was a very, even in death, protected individual with lawyers and very discreet friends and family members around him. And so the first year of this book was really hard. I had to do a lot of groveling, a lot of begging. Initially, people were not talking to me so much. It took about a year, year and a half for that to begin to change. One of the things I did was I went on a trip to England, as I had to do in order to interview people, and go to the British Library. And I sat in front of a terminal at the British Library looking on databases and microfilm for British articles that had been written about George. And I was there for 7 days, I guess, and I came home with 800 articles. Ultimately, that number grew to way over 2,000 articles that I found. And trust me, that's a smidgen of what exists. So when I write one of these books, I get obsessed because I just feel I have to talk to everybody. I have to find everything. I have to unseal every little locked treasure trove or Pandora's box. And of course you can't do that. So I thoroughly drive myself crazy, but it's, and then the point comes when you have to hand the thing in and you know that you could have gone farther. But if you don't let go, then the thing will just never appear. And so I'm very dedicated to my job because I have people's lives in my hands. I take this very seriously. Anytime I make even the smallest mistake, it's a knife through my heart because I work so hard at getting to the truth. And so, you know, luckily, I would say with all of my biographies, the number of mistakes reported to me at the end are small. And the George book is, as I said, it's now circling the world. So I've gotten to do interviews in New Zealand, Australia, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, all kinds of places, and you in Little Rock. And to answer your original question, I'm so honored that anybody would be interested enough to ask.
Well, I mean, you know, you said a lot there. You did a lot of research. I would think just the legwork of doing the research. I mean, you can't just fly to England. You need to have interviews set up ahead of time, correct?
Yes. And I went to this in the summer, June of 2018, I flew to France in order to interview and actually stay for a couple of days with Danny Cummings, who was George's longtime percussionist and loved George and was very close to George in many ways. And I had a handful of interviews that led to more interviews, because if it goes well with somebody who's taking a chance on you,
yes,
and maybe was skeptical at the beginning, but then if it goes well and they feel safe, then they'll refer you to other people and put in a good word for you. And that is how it all started to unfold for me. I'm a good interviewer. I do my homework. I love interviewing more than anything. And interviewing and research are a joy for me. Writing is hell, but all the everything that leads up to it, I love.
I'm curious, some of the other people you got to, did you make it to Andrew Ridgely?
Sadly, no. Andrew Ridgely hates giving interviews. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that he had not given a single interview after about 1990. Wham! Broke up in 1986. And then Andrew wrote his own memoir. And I watched Andrew on British morning television giving the obligatory interviews and looking very uncomfortable with the whole thing. I didn't attempt to get to Andrew because enough people who knew him said it ain't gonna happen. There were people like Elton John that I pursued, Boy George, lots of other people, George's backup singers. I could only get to one of them, but her name was DC Lee, and she was an early Wham backup singer. She, prior to Pepsi taking over, Shirley and Pepsi being the two famous Wham backup singers. She talked to me and was marvelous. And every interview that I did was great. It's sometimes getting them that's the torture, because whatever my cred is, these people don't know me. Sure. They can look at my website. They can look at quotes and reviews of my past work, but still they're uneasy being asked a lot of probing questions by a stranger. And you have to, the hardest part of my job is getting people to talk to me. It had not actually been a problem with any of my prior books. I interviewed hundreds of people for each of them, and almost everybody said yes. But in George's case, it was different, because George had lived his life in hiding. There were great layers of secrecy surrounding George Michael, and the people who remained the closest to him were the ones who kept his secrets, and they continued to keep his secrets even after he was gone.
I always thought he kind of had something similar to Madonna, in that he had this great ability to reinvent himself when he was ready to do that. His looks and all of the guy was, I mean, he was incredible talent. I'm so sad we don't have him still on tour today.
I'm sad too. But I think that by the time George bailed, and I do believe that he bailed, he was ready to go. He was completely spent. I think that he'd given all that he had to give, Scott. It's sad to think that he was wiped out at that point, but he was, his body was giving way. He wasn't healthy. He had more or less lost the ability to write songs. His singing voice was severely diminished at that time. And although he had a couple of projects, they were looking back projects that he had at the end of his life. One of them was the creation of this documentary that came out posthumously, in which he was, before he wrapped it all up and said goodbye, although he didn't articulate it as such at the time, he was going to just make sure that his truth, quote unquote, was put out there. But in terms of new touring, new recordings, new songwriting, he was done. He was just done. Many times a great artist dies, and we mourn the fact that they had so much left to give. And I don't think that was true of George.
You know, if George was coming up right now, I just think Hollywood probably would have treated him differently. Because, I mean, I was 14, you know, years old, probably about the time he hit with Faith. And I thought that was still think it's one of the greatest songs ever recorded. And as simple as it is, I think it's only bested by Thriller as a music video. But that's just my thought on it. I mean, I love that video. Did anybody talk about the behind the scenes of producing those videos? Freedom was extremely cutting edge, you know, loved Faith.
I've devoted a lot of space to the creation of those videos. I couldn't do it with every video because there are so many, but those videos all have really fun stories attached. My favorite story of the creation of a video was that of the song Too Funky, which was his second Supermodels video.
Yep.
The Freedom 90 story is really fun, but the Too Funky story could be a movie unto itself, in which the designer Thierry Mugler was going to direct a video of this terrific dance song. And he and George was a control freak. Thierry Mugler was a control freak. They butted heads in outrageous ways until George finally wrested the whole thing away from Thierry Mugler after there had been a finished edit of this video. And George made, in my opinion, a much safer and duller version of the Too Funky video. The original Thierry Mugler cut can be seen on YouTube, and it's one of the great music videos I've ever seen. It's simply outrageous.
Where are some of the items? Like, I would love to know, where is that original Revenge, Rocker Revenge jacket? You know, where are those jeans or those sunglasses or the ear? I mean, they should be in a museum or something somewhere, in my mind.
I agree with you. I've never seen them on display anywhere, and I've never laid eyes on the originals of those things. Many of them are still in George's possession, in the possession of his family. There's not much of his family left. One of his sisters died on Christmas Day 3 years after George died, his sister Melanie. George's other sister is alive and well. George's dad is alive, but not so well. And it's interesting, as it was recently pointed out to me, there are no heirs in the family. The two girls didn't have kids. George, of course, didn't have kids. And so the family name ends with that, with George's dad. It's very touching to contemplate the fact that the estate is fantastically rich, first of all.
Sure.
The estimate I've been told is $100 million. Is it dollars? Is it pounds? I'm not quite sure. But it's this extraordinary sum of money. And but furthermore, there is not a gold mine of unreleased material. Most of what can come out has come out. George only made 6 albums under his own name, in addition to the Wham stuff and singles and other doodads. But the catalog is not large, but the catalog is forever.
Was he asked to sing on We Are the World? He really should be in that group.
You know, this is the first time anyone has asked me that. And to the best of my knowledge, he was not. There were a lot of people left off of that video, of course.
Prince said he was not perform with anybody else. It wouldn't do it. But George should be there.
George should be there. And I don't know. If he was asked, I have not heard that he was asked. Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
But he had done that big Live Aid. He was in Live Aid, of course. He was an immensely likable guy, Scott. In all the people that I interviewed, ultimately, he could be exasperating to his friends, and more they were worried about him, but they loved him. This was a very lovable guy, great sense of humor. And in the final years, as you know, he was appearing on all those comedy TV shows episodic television, poking fun at himself, having a big laugh at his own expense.
Where can people go and find the book, George Michael, A Life?
Just go to Amazon and make your life simpler if you really want it. And I hope your listeners will pick it up. I promise that it will touch the hearts of your listeners, because George, when all was said and done, he was an immensely human, flawed, wonderful guy who made music that made us feel good. He could also make us feel sad. But George, when people hear the name George Michael, I think their mind immediately goes to the happy dance songs that made us all feel 10 feet tall.
Talking with James Gavin, he has a book out called George Michael, A Life. You can get it on Amazon. And what an honor to be selected to write this book about George. I mean, like you said earlier, lots of people wanted to do it, I guess.
We got a lot of no's on this book. I thought that George Michael would be the easy, no-brainer, quick sell of my life. And instead, a number of publishers wanted another quick book to cash in on the death, so I would have had to do a 6-month turnaround. And others felt that he was a disgraced and fallen relic of 1980s pop. And this was around the same time that Prince, Lou Reed, Leonard Cohen, and David Bowie all died. And multiple books were signed about all those great icons. But I didn't nobody else was, as far as I know, trying to write this book, which blew my mind. And then when it came out, and even before it came out, I was getting so many inquiries, so many requests, and there was so much interest flooding in from the whole world, literally, about this book, that I realized that I was right and those editors were wrong. Well, ultimately, Abrams, a wonderful editor at Abrams named David Cashion, who adored George Michael, he fought it through at Abrams. And Abrams is more of a art book publisher. It's a hallowed old New York publisher with a great reputation going back forever. But the kind of narrative book that I write is not what they're known for, but they wanted it. And so they've treated me beautifully, and it continues to grow and spread all over the world.
You know, James, I've always felt like George Michael was like the last star that was treated like old Hollywood in a way. I mean, obviously Rock Hudson was, you know, in the public. He was not gay. And of course they treated George Michael that way. When I was a kid, I thought the guy was dating Cindy Crawford. They would put that, you remember that they would make things like that. And then the Faith video comes. I'm wanting to be George Michael. This guy is the next Elvis Presley. But it's like all mm-hmm. of that was like a facade, you know, which I don't think that today Hollywood would work that hard to put out such a false image of a person. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. It's not as necessary now as it was back in George's day of the 1980s and early 90s. George set his sights very early on becoming the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
And he also very quickly figured out that in order to get where he wanted to get, he would have to hide who he was and create a whole other persona. And he created this iconic persona that now, looking back at it, is so gay because it uses a lot of gay fashion iconography. The leather jacket and the clone look, the facial stubble and the shades and so forth. But it wasn't perceived that way at the time at all.
No, it wasn't.
And people were a lot more naive back then. And if you look at any George Michael concert videos from those days, if you look, there are more than one version of the entire Faith concert from the Faith tour of 1988 online, and you can see who's screaming for him. And it was young women and girls who were going nuts over George Michael. And until I would say the early 90s, the rumor did not, it was festering, but it didn't begin to burble through until, I don't know, 1992, 93. And part of the reason for that is that George was singing "I Want Your Sex." He was he had risen to the top as a sex icon, and he didn't want to talk about whose sex he wanted. And people were beginning to ask legitimate questions, and he was being very cagey about it. And the more secretive he remained, the more people became insistent and started probing and probing away. And even as of the time that George was arrested in a public men's room in 1998 in Beverly Hills, in a park, beautiful park called Will Rogers Memorial Park, he had no intention of giving them what they wanted. He did not want to say the words "I am gay," and he, in a sense, forced himself out of the closet.
We were so naive. If you just listen to the words of freedom, he's truly given it away in the song.
Yeah,
spells it out. Yeah, he just spells it out.
I know at that time the freedom song was, on the surface of it at least, about him wanting to bust out of the chains of pop superstardom and big record companies and play in the game and get at some truer version of himself that he'd never shown before. And yet now we listen to it and we can hear all of the undercurrents. George really created a cage for himself. Like I said earlier, he took the necessary steps to get to where he wanted to go. And in that time of the late 80s, he knew that he could never begin to get there unless he hid who he really was. And that is what created lifelong conflicts in George that just escalated and escalated, and literally until he died.
Well, we're in Little Rock, and most people don't realize, as I understand it, George Michael lived in Dallas, Texas, like in the mid-90s.
Kind of. He had a house there because he had a boyfriend named Kenny Goss, who was Dallas-based, and they owned an art gallery together, which is to say Kenny ran it and George financed this art gallery. But George spent a lot of time in Texas. You're absolutely right.
You mentioned the arrest and the things that kind of brought him out in the world, but you know, he was very candid about that kind of thing on David Letterman and other shows. But was that ultimately the thing that really set him into seclusion and where he just disappeared from the world? I mean, did it bother him more than he let on?
God, yes. Absolutely. That's a very astute statement you just made, because he was forced to go on TV, CNN, MTV, network television, Letterman, and so forth, and do damage control, because he had some explaining to do. He not only had to explain how the hell he had allowed this to happen, but also why he had never come out at a time when big celebrities who were gay or lesbian were being pressured by the team to come out and support the cause. And people were that the gay establishment was mad at George because this did not make them look good. So now George was out in a way he had never anticipated, and he had to somehow. He saw his whole career teetering. He knew that he was in many people's eyes a laughingstock, and he had to do some damage control. And from that point on, he was aggressively out and loud. But George lived with a great sense of shame and self-hatred that had been instilled in him in childhood. And many people never shake that completely. And George, it helped cement a path of self-destruction that just escalated until he died.
Hey, it's almost that time of year, so one of the last things I want to ask you about, Christmas must have meant a lot to George Michael. He is known for two of the biggest Christmas songs, Last Christmas by Wham. Everyone knows that. And Do They Know It's Christmas, or Do They Know It's Christmas At All? The origin of those things, was Christmas just huge in his life? Heck, he died on Christmas.
The irony of the fact that George Michael died ostensibly alone, as far as we know, he was alone when he died. But the great irony, Last Christmas, of course, is a very sad song about being alone at Christmas time anyway, and it came true for George. Did Christmas mean a lot to him? It did. He had great sentimental feelings for Christmas, and he would buy in his fancy hilltop neighborhood of Highgate in London. He spent a lot of money to make the neighborhood Christmassy, including paying for a big Christmas tree in the neighborhood. He did it all quietly. George was a quiet philanthropist. He wasn't doing it to take bows. But it did. Christmas touched his heart. And so the fact that he was alone on Christmas Day, as far as we know, and that it all ended that way, gives incredible poignancy to that sweet little childlike Wham song.
And you have been a great guest. I hope everyone will go out and pick up this book, George Michael, A Life. It's on Amazon. James Gavin, you can check him out at jamesgavin.com, G-A-V-I-N. Thank you so much for being on Gwatney Unplugged.
Scott, I could talk to you for hours more. What a joy.
Thank you so much. Hey, you guys go out and have a great Saturday. We'll see you next week right here on 102.9 KRN.